You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Southern Poverty Center reported that by 2015, the anti-government movement had experienced, quote, a resurgence growing quickly since 2008 when President Obama was elected to office. Some of the factors fueling that growth include changing demographics driven by immigration, the struggling economy, and fears that rural America is under assault. A galvanizing moment for anti-government militias was the standoff between the Bundy ranching family and the federal government, the subject of American Patriot Inside the Armed Uprising Against the Federal Government, a new Frontline documentary from director-producer Rick Rowley. It airs locally tonight at 10 on WNET, and I'm pleased it has brought Rick Rowley back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks, Sue.
Are you worried, because you really try to be as even-handed as possible, that some viewers might see your portrayal of the Bundy family and militia groups in general as being in a somewhat sympathetic light at times?
Well, I mean, this film really is about the clash of different American realities. And the country, I mean, America is divided, more economically divided than it's been since before the Great Depression, and the cultural divide is every bit as great. So, you know, in the ring cities that we live in, where economic and cultural power are concentrated, you know, much of rural America is opaque and incomprehensible to us. And so this this film was an attempt to look into that blind spot, because in that blind spot, you know, storms have been brewing, as we've all seen in these last years.
And both sides cite the Constitution as justification for their positions.
Yeah. So when I started this film, you know, in 2009, I made a piece for television about the rising white nationalist and white supremacist movement, going, you know, filming with skinheads and neo-Nazis and racist border militias, and saw them sort of pushing into the Tea Party, into the more mainstream parts of the Republican Party. When I began this, I thought I was making the same film. You know, that was the kind of my understanding of what the Bundy kind of struggle was about. And, you know, over the course of 8 or 9 months working on this, the situation was much more complex and nuanced.
Although some of those people do play a role in the story. When did Clive and Bundy's stand against the Bureau of Land Management first take place?
Well, so in 2014, I mean, you may remember the headlines and the coverage of the standoff at Bundy Ranch, but this kind of conflict has been brewing for decades at least.
Hadn't the family been involved in a decades-long battle with the BLM? Was it simply over grazing rights for cattle on federal lands?
Yeah, so the situation there is interesting, and it's a little bit complex. I mean, all ranchers in Nevada are public lands ranchers, because in Nevada it's high desert. You need 100 acres for a cow-calf pair to survive. So so yes, there's been a perennial struggle between the Bureau of Land Management and ranchers over access to land.
And most of the land in Nevada is owned by the federal government. It's been that way for a long time. It's the reason that atomic bomb tests could be conducted there during World War II. But did the Bundy family believe that this land was theirs?
No, and that's something that has been sort of misreported. Their position, their ideological position, is not that the land belongs to them as private property. It's that this is these are public lands which are kind of like a commons, and their objection is that they don't think the federal government should manage them. They think that they should be managed locally by state or county authorities.
Well, part of the argument is over how much they should be paying to graze their cattle there. Would they be any happier if they were paying the state of Nevada to graze their cattle there?
And see, that's another thing. Actually, money had nothing to do with the, or had very little to do with the actual impoundment process. What happened was, in 1993, the BLM started to make, was making changes to the permits there. The BLM had decided that they wanted to slowly phase out ranching in Clark County. And so they were limiting the number of months in the year that cows could be grazed on the parcel. So to a point where all the ranchers went out of business, or they sold out, and Clive and Bundy was the last one to stay there because he refused to take his cows off the land. The fees, he just stopped paying the fees out of protest, but the reason the cows were impounded was basically because the permit was canceled.
So why does the government want to get rid of all these people?
I mean, it is...
there is no economic rationale for public lands ranching anymore. I mean, if all the public lands ranching in America disappeared, it wouldn't increase the price of beef one penny, probably. It's important locally to local economies, but Clark County is home to Las Vegas, a city of 2 million people that's constantly expanding.
Isn't 47% of the land in the West overall owned by the federal government? Has it been allowing ranchers to let their cattle graze on for a long time?
Yeah, for 100 years. I mean, the Bundys and many ranching families in Nevada can trace their family back there for five or six generations. Before Nevada was a state, the Bundys were ranching there.
So now that the Western state cattle ranchers are in decline, does that mean that we are importing more beef from other places, or are larger cattle ranchers in other parts of the country putting some of these Western ranchers out of business?
So that's when we talked to a bunch of kind of experts and historians of land struggles in the West, and one of the things that they sort of point to is that really the economic consolidation of the beef industry and the globalization of it is the real economic engine that's putting people out of business. I mean, now there is one meatpacking concern in the entire Western Hemisphere that manages all of this, and there's just no room for marginal operations like these to survive. So really, getting rid of the BLM would not really help them.
Where's our beef coming from, then?
You know, Brazil and parts of Latin America, a lot of beef is being imported from. And also there are much larger, corporate farms other places.
So when Clive and Bundy refused to pay after the federal government demanded $1 million in back grazing fees, the BLM, along with FBI agents, began to round up his cattle. And then they just put it somewhere nearby?
Well, so the plan was, it's maybe 800 or 900 head of cattle spread over 800,000 acres, like a massive area of land, because it takes—
That's a lot of grass that they're eating.
Or a little bit of grass over many, many acres. Every cow needs 100 acres to survive out there. So they set up a corral that they, had gates and was set up like a kind of mini military base. And then it took weeks to round up the cattle. They rounded up about half of them into this base. And during that period of time, the Bundys started to call for help to stop this impound.
And they were calling other cattle ranchers? Why did militia groups get involved?
Well, so this is the thing that makes this an important and pivotal moment for the militia movement in America, because ranchers have done this kind of thing for a very long time, and ranchers support each other. So a lot of the ranchers from the state came and rallied to the Bundys' cause, but then there was a confrontation that ended up turning into a YouTube clip that went viral. Ammon Bundy, Clive and Bundy's son, was tasered in a confrontation with BLM agents, and that clip went viral, and suddenly militias from around the country adopted them as a symbol of anti-government resistance, and they rallied to their cause.
My guest is Rick Rowley, a filmmaker who also, with fellow producer Jeremy Scahill, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature for Dirty Wars in 2013. The film under discussion today, American Patriot, Inside the Armed Uprising Against the Federal Government, will be broadcast as part of the Frontline series tonight at 10 p.m. on Channel 13 here in New York. The American military is the most powerful in the world. What do these people hope to achieve by taking a stand against the federal government, no matter how well-armed they were?
Well, they ended up winning, which was a bizarre thing. At that moment, at that time, 200 armed militiamen came from around the country from national networks like the 3% Militia and the Oath Keepers, which are probably the biggest national networks now. They came to Bunkerville. And on the final day of the standoff, there's a rally downtown, and Clive and Bundy says, "Let's go get my cattle." And they rush out to the gates, and they surround these BLM agents there. There are maybe 50 armed agents from a half dozen different law enforcement agencies who are there.
And they have guns.
And they're heavily armed, yes. Mm. Yeah, so they have one of the militia members who was there describes the scene to us, said they had snipers in, the BLM and the federal agents had snipers in, so they put in place counter snipers. And the Steve Ellis, who was the deputy director of the BLM at the time, said it's not worth risking the loss of life over 400 cows. This is ridiculous. And he stood them down and released the cows.
But this was an illegal action.
Yeah, it definitely was in violation of the law. I mean, there is not really a coherent legal argument that says that the Bundys have a right to have their cows on the land after their permit's been canceled.
Wasn't Waco on everyone's mind at the time? Was that a factor here?
Waco is the ghost that haunts all of the interactions between the FBI and militias since then. And so, yeah, I mean, if someone had been killed there, this could have turned into a much more catalyzing moment.
So the Bundy family believes that the fact that the cattle was returned to them and they didn't have to immediately pay the grazing fees is a victory. Are they going to have to pay the grazing fees in the end?
Well, I think that in the end now, you know, 3 years later, so many things have happened between now and then, and the Bundys are in prison, and they may very well spend the rest of their lives there. I think that it's hard to imagine their ranching operation continuing now in any way.
What message did this whole thing at that point, before they wound up going to prison, send to the rest of America? I feel that the income tax is unfair, and many Americans would feel that way, could I just organize an armed standoff?
Yeah, but it's important that it wasn't a fight over fees. It was a fight over the permit itself. The BLM was saying you can no longer have your cows on the land here, and we're slowly going to end ranching here. So it was not just the narrative that I went in looking for was that these were welfare ranchers who just wanted to stop paying, wanted to freeload completely. But that the situation is a little bit more nuanced than that. But still, clearly, the BLM has the authority to decide the terms by which this land is used. And if they decide that development of a city of 2 million people is more important than one rancher left on their land, it's their decision to make.
Clive and Bundy became a hero of the growing militia movement and the face-off of an armed uprising against the long arm of the federal government made him into a hero as well. And then he said to an interviewer, quote, "I want to tell you one more thing I know about the Negro. I've often wondered, are they better off as slaves, picking cotton and having a family life and doing things, or are they better off under government subsidy?" Now, where did that come from? This was not a racial issue.
Yeah. So Clive and Bundy, in the days after the standoff, becomes this hero to the right, villain to the left. And then in an interview with the New York Times that someone films on their cell phone, makes these racist comments. And suddenly, for many of us, it looked like the mask had slipped.
Was he talking to the white supremacists who had been part members of the militia groups who had supported him?
No, in talking with the groups that monitor the right-wing extremism and racial extremism, the Southern Poverty Law Center and Political Research Associates are the two leading groups in the country. They make a distinction between racist extremism and anti-government extremism that they say is, increasingly important and significant. And they, their perspective on this is that Clive and Bundy may be an old racist rancher, but that actually race is not a motivating factor in his politics, and that their movement and most of the militia movements that were there were anti-government extremist groups, not racist extremists. There's overlap, of course, and that those groups sometimes work together, but they're importantly different.
Well, some of his supporters wanted Clive and Bundy to also talk about Benghazi and healthcare.
Yeah. Well, so that's the thing that is the base reality that we sort of discovered. For the Bundys, this was a really concrete struggle over trying to keep their ranch and trying to keep the federal government from, ending their grazing permit there. Once they win this fight here, they're adopted as symbols of a whole bunch of different kind of groups. So it's Sean Hannity who embraces the Bundys first and puts Clive and Bundy on television and makes him a symbol of the little guy standing up to tyrannical government overreach and talks about Benghazi and healthcare and all these things. And that was always an uncomfortable fit. The militias adopt him as a hero of their anti-government movement, even though they're not ranchers and they have very different kinds of interests. So what starts out is a ranching family, without setting aside for a moment the complexities of their land dispute, a ranching family fighting to try to save their land, they turn into these heroes of a right-wing movement.
And then Ammon Bundy becomes the spokesperson. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what happened after that. My guest is Rick Rowley. His latest film is called American Patriot, Inside the Armed Uprising Against the Federal Government. It airs tonight on locally here on WNET at 10 p.m. Stay with us for more. Rick Rowley is my guest. He's a filmmaker. His latest, American Patriot Inside the Armed Uprising Against the Federal Government, frontline documentary that will be airing tonight at 10 on WNET here in New York. So after Cliven was disgraced by his racist remarks, his son Ammon becomes the spokesman for the family. These names do not sound typical to an Easterner's ear. Are they common in that area?
Yeah, Cliven and Ammon, they're Mormons. They're deeply religious Mormons who were, their ancestors were originally sent as kind of pioneers and settlers to this like arid bit of land called the Mormon Strip. And so, their names are drawn from their faith.
And Ammon begins to gain an online following. What is he preaching?
So Ammon begins to travel around the country speaking about his interpretation of the Constitution, and which is really actually tied up with his Mormon faith.
And he participated quite a bit in the making of your film. It comes across as rather sophisticated and reasonable. Did that and actually perhaps a bit more reasonable than some of the militia group leaders. Does he believe in armed insurrection?
He believes that, or he said to us many times that, you know, how could you not believe that some kind of war was coming? That they feel like the Constitution and the kind of this country is hanging by a thread, it is under threat, and that it needs to be defended.
So you said he was traveling around the country, and then he hears the story of a father and son in trouble in Oregon, the Hammonds.
Yeah.
He saw them as kindred spirits?
Yeah. The Hammonds were another ranching family who had similar struggles with with the Bureau of Land Management, and who were going to jail. Had served time for some fires they'd set. The Hammonds claimed they were controlled burns. The BLM called them arson. They served a sentence, but under a mandatory minimum that was imposed under an anti-terrorism statute, were going back to jail.
Well, controlled burns, they endangered people, homes, and wildlife. So were they really just signs of rebellion?
Well, they were found guilty by a jury. So they were found guilty by a jury, but the judge said the arsons fell under an anti-terrorism statute that was put in place after Timothy McVeigh. And so there was a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years. The judge thought that was outrageous and so reduced their sentence to 3 months and 1 year respectively for them. And once they were released, they were re-prosecuted by the federal prosecutors and were sent back to jail. So that was what created the outrage for ranchers in the area.
And part of this story is also friendly judges.
Yeah. I mean, the
juries and friendly judges.
The prosecutor, Billy Williams, who's the U.S. attorney in Portland, you know, he also expressed sympathy for them and frustration with the mandatory minimum sentences, but says this is the law, it's mandated by Congress, and we can't just deviate from this. Yeah.
So Ammon decides to take on the Hammonds' cause, organize a rally for them. Some of the same groups who joined the Bundy's Bunker Hill rally in Nevada came out to Burns, Oregon. Which groups decided to go with him and which groups decided not to?
Well, so many of the groups came to the original rally for the Hammonds in downtown Burns. They were just going to march around Burns, have a rally in a Safeway parking lot.
Mostly cattle ranchers, farmers, cowboys, or are we talking about militia?
No, the militias by that point were there in full force. After the Bundy Ranch standoff, militias in Oregon were energized and organized by it. They'd met each other for the first time there, and they organized a network in the region called the Pacific Patriots Network, which was there in force.
Do we know how the Hammonds felt about being at the center of this protest?
Well, the Hammonds – so the protest itself, the march and then the rally in the Safeway parking lot, everyone was fine with. In the Safeway parking lot, Ammon announces to the crowd, "This is not enough. The Hammonds are going to go to jail for 5 years, and we're just going to sit here in a parking lot. If you want to really do something, come with me to the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, where we're going to take a hard stand." And he races out there with a couple of dozen people, while most of the militias stay behind in Burns and say, "That's a step too far. We're not ready." So he ended up, over the course of those 2 years, becoming more radical and more ready for militant action than the militias who had originally rallied to his support.
How did the FBI respond to this escalation?
Well, the FBI was monitoring the situation. They had two agents there in Burns, you know, because of the militia presence there, seeing what was going on. And they And they instantly, you know, brought a force into Burns, but they were very careful. Again, you know, the shadow of Waco was hanging over everything. So they stayed back and they tried to remain hidden and they didn't, you know, start a confrontation.
Were Ammon and his followers prepared for a long standoff?
They, it seems that the site was chosen to be the location for a long standoff. So, yeah, they were hoping, imagine that maybe thousands of people would end up rushing out there. But it seems that Ammon had, you know, the fascinating thing about Ammon here is that 2 years before this, he was a diesel mechanic in Phoenix, like a, you know, an unknown person. He'd been thrown into the spotlight going back to try to save his family's ranch. And now he was way out ahead in terms of militancy of all of the militias who'd rallied to support him.
But the way he talks to you in this film, it sounds like he'd been ranching all the time. And this was his life. This was his joy. But he was actually a mechanic.
Well, as he tells us, when he turned 16, his father told him, you know, the ranch can, he's one of 14 children. And he was told the ranch can't support all of us. And so you have to go to the city and, you know, find your own way. And so he left. And so that also makes him interesting too, because he's he's a character who's already living nostalgia for this world that has been dying since before he was even born.
So they take over Mayhew?
Malheur.
Malheur. They take it over. And what are they doing there?
So they take it over, and the standoff lasts 21 days, or the first phase of the standoff. So they tell us that they thought they would be there for a week, maybe that the FBI would come and they would be arrested for trespassing. But the FBI doesn't want to provoke an armed confrontation that would only catalyze the movement further. So they hang back, and they're holding classes on the Constitution, political rallies and events out there. They are staging photo ops from time to time. And it drags on and on.
And the people of the town aren't all that happy with Bundy's presence. They start telling him to go home.
A real division, a split opens up in the town. So the town is really conservative and in general supported the Hammonds completely, but didn't support this kind of radical action outside and also felt endangered by it. I mean, when all the militia members came back to town to try to, you know, claim that they were there to defend the Bundys against the FBI, I mean, they were creating a military base basically in the middle of this community. So most of the town was calling for them to go.
Now, I always think of Oregon as a rather liberal area. In fact, Portlandia makes fun of the kind of extreme liberalism. But this is a part of the state that is not?
Yeah, just like America in general. I mean, Oregon has Portland, an incredible liberal mecca on the in the West, but in the East, it is it's red. It's red state America.
The part that's near Utah.
Yeah.
My guest is Rick Rowley, a filmmaker whose latest is American Patriot, Inside the Armed Uprising Against the Federal Government, frontline documentary that will be broadcast tonight at 10 on WNET. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A caller is asking about the racial aspect. Are these white people treated better than black or Native American people who have done similar actions?
Unquestionably. I mean, the idea of a double standard here it's absolutely clear, I think, to everyone that if the occupiers of the Malheur Refuge were Muslim or if they were black, it would have ended.
As we saw with Wounded Knee, for example.
Yeah, exactly. The last kind of reference we have for something, the most recent reference for something like this that we have. But the point is, though, that doesn't mean that we should hope for the FBI to come in and really violently crack down on them, that we should hope that everyone was dealt with as much attempt was made to de-escalate the situation with every action like this.
And so when the FBI finally decided that it had to move in, it tried to do it under the safest of circumstances. What point was that?
So on the occupation had been going on for 21 days, the FBI found out that a group of the leadership was traveling, leaving the refuge to travel to another county to hold a meeting outside in John Day County. It was a longer convoy, but the two tail cars had Ammon Bundy and Lavoie Finicum, who was the spokesman and one of the other leaders of the movement, in the lead car, along with a couple other organizers, and Shauna Cox, who's a character who we talked to, who was filming the whole thing on her cell phone. So they get to a twisty mountain road that I've driven back and forth on many times that's outside of cell phone range. And
that was important, that it was outside of cell phone range?
They didn't want them to be able to call in help, right? They didn't want to, if they barricaded themselves in their cars and wait for militia supporters to arrive outside. So as soon as they were in this area outside of cell phone range, they performed a traffic stop, which is not normally... the safest way to apprehend someone, but they did in this case because it was the only way to get them outside of the range of anyone.
And it turned ugly.
So the tail car, Ammon Bundy, is arrested immediately. In the lead car, Lavoie Finicum refuses to get out. You see in the film, we have footage, cell phone footage from inside, and a drone footage shot by the FBI above overhead. Says, you know, we're not getting out of the car. If you're going to shoot me, put the laser right here, put the bullet through my head. I'm going to John Day. So the passengers duck down and he goes for it. And he races down this twisting mountain road till he hits another FBI checkpoint, skids off the road, pops out of the car. You can see him from the drone with his hands in the air for a moment. It appears in the drone like he's reaching for a pocket or something, and the FBI shoot him in the snow.
Did he have a gun?
The whole incident is under internal investigation by the FBI, so the details of it are, you know, not really known.
But that became another big incident, and conservatives complained that this was a federal government overreach.
It did. You know, I mean, I should say that He was known to always have been armed. He often carried a gun, and every time we see a picture of him, he had a gun. So it was not unreasonable to assume he was. But it turned into, he became a symbol and a martyr for this movement, and his cattle brand is on flags and things now.
Perhaps the most surprising part of this story is what happened once Ammon and his followers were brought to the courts. Wasn't it assumed that they would be found guilty? After all, they'd been armed, and they'd taken over federal buildings and federal lands.
Yeah, not only that, but they documented it meticulously on their own Facebook and YouTube channels. I mean, there was no shortage of evidence. The prosecutors had 1,000 pieces of evidence entered into the record. Everyone thought it was going to be a slam dunk, you know, conviction. But the prosecution ran into a couple of problems really early on.
Well, first of all, there seemed to be a sympathetic judge who made a ruling that hurt the prosecution's case.
Well, I mean, the sympathies of the judge are hard to tell. I think there were rulings that went either way. I mean, which ruling are you referring
to? He wouldn't allow some things to be put into evidence, things that would have really made a stronger case.
Well, I mean, the one thing that differed between there were two trials, right? This was the trial for the leadership in which everyone was acquitted. There was a trial after it for lower down people in the conspiracy, and they were convicted. And one of the differences was, I mean, there were many differences in the way the prosecution ran their case, but one of them was that the judge allowed the refuge workers to come in and testify to the trauma that this caused them. A reason why a judge might choose to exclude that would be if they think the case of the prosecution is very strong and they want to prevent an appeal from happening. So you can do this to make the appeal more difficult.
Part of the problem was that the prosecutors had conspiracy charges put against these people. Conspiracy is what seemed to upset the jury.
Yeah. So the main prosecutor, Ethan Knight, told us that, you know, there aren't a lot of charges in their playbook. There's no real playbook for what to do when a wildlife refuge is occupied. So they don't they could have charged them with trespassing. They could have charged them with destroying government property. They could have charged them with theft and other small things. But those are all misdemeanors in the federal code. They thought that this action rose to the level of felony, and the only felony that fit was conspiracy to impede a federal employee, which was a difficult thing to prove in the end.
So you mentioned earlier that Ammon and Cliven are now in jail, but not in connection to this, in connection to their Nevada ranch.
Yeah, an amazing moment. So the trial goes on. There are all these twists and turns and revelations of FBI informants who are working inside and might be implicated in some things. And in the end, the city is shocked by this acquittal. In the courtroom, as the sentence is being read, the lawyer for Ammon Bundy stands up and says, "Okay, he's been freed of charges here. He's going to, you know, we already know that he's going to face charges in Nevada, but show me an arrest warrant." and otherwise you need to set him free. And the wardens didn't have an arrest warrant there, and the marshals didn't have an arrest warrant. And he gets in an argument with them, and they wrestle him to the ground, and they tase him in the middle of the courtroom. An unprecedented sight, a defense attorney being, like, wrestled to the ground and tased. But then he was later released, and Ammon was shipped to Nevada, where he is now facing charges for the Bunkerville standoff 3 years ago.
And when is their trial going to begin?
It's scheduled for June 23rd right now.
Has the Bureau of Land Management changed any of its policies under the new administration? Would that at all apply to the Bundys?
I think it would not. I don't think there's anything they would do that could really affect the Bundys at this point. I mean, what's being put on the table mostly with the BLM is talking about recategorizing some national monuments as not national monuments and making it easier for, lands to be sold off. But in Clark County, public ranching is basically done.
The lands would be sold off actually for mining, not for ranching.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. That's one of the kind of tragic paradoxes of all this. Like, people have risked their lives, risked other people's lives, risked a lifetime in jail. And if the clearest policy prescription that they have is to transfer management to states, and in many of the state constitution, it actually mandates that the state government needs to try to maximize revenue off the land, which means selling it to, extractive industries or whatever else.
Despite the fact that the public lands movement began with Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, no, exactly, exactly.
Rick Rowley's latest film is American Patriot, Inside the Armed Uprising Against the Federal Government. It is a frontline film that will be aired tonight at 10 p.m. here in New York on WNET. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.